This is an Enterprise Time Security podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Ira Goldstein of the Herjavec Group.
Hi, Ira Goldstein from the Herjavec Group. I'm the Senior Vice President of Corporate Development for one of the world's largest independent managed security services companies.
You've been talking at an event today about the challenge of identity management. We've seen in the last couple of days HSBC in the US get hit by credential stuffing. How do we improve identity management?
Well, the first thing we do with our customers is look at their current state and assess their current state. And I think that everyone who faces the challenge of identity governance or of managing privileged IDs or service accounts, which is every modern enterprise, needs to take real stock of their current state and understand what their main weaknesses and strengths are. For example, if you have a big customer identity component to your business, really, these identity programs, to be successful, need to deliver business value. So if customer identity is seminal to what you do, you need to look at the customer identity problem, make sure you're making it easy for customers on one hand, but that you govern the customer identity in a way that won't lead to the type of public breaches that we've seen around customer identity. If there's one of the most prevalent and public challenges around identity, it's customer identity management. Hand in hand with that, though, is internal identity governance and your business to business, but also your business internal. A lot of people try to approach this problem with tools, and there are an overload of tools. Part of my workshop was looking at the current state of mergers and acquisitions and identity, and it's wild out there. If you look to the guys and girls in Silicon Valley, if it's any indication of where the market is going, where the money is, you've seen recent acquisition of BeyondTrust, which before that was a succession of acquisitions of BombGuard, the remote access company, Avecto at the endpoint, and Lieberman, a privileged access company. And so what these private equity firms are really trying to do is bundle niche identity providers together to deliver the killer app for identity. I don't think that's there yet. You see interesting public companies like SailPoint and CyberArk making waves in the identity governance and the privileged access world. But really approaching this problem means understanding your current state and not necessarily jumping into the tool selection and finding the tool that's right, because there may not be a tool that's right for you. You may need to figure out your own roadmap and strategy and fix up your process first before entering the world of the tools.
But trying to understand what that identity is also a challenge. If we look at Scandinavia, we've had projects in place now for 10, 15 years to tie somebody to an identity number from the moment they're born. If we look inside enterprises, when somebody joins an enterprise, their identity is established, but then everything fills from that without necessarily knowing so much about that individual. If we look at regulation in banking, we have Know Your Customer rules. And from a business perspective, they're incredibly intrusive, yet they still continue to fail, and we still have shell companies set up, we still have a lot of fraud takes place. How do we boil this subject down to that most essential thing of ensuring that that identity really is that individual, that company, that object, and that it remains that and is immutable?
It's a huge challenge, and this is where the innovations in identity are coming in. The problem that you describe is verifying an identity at source. If I go to pick up my package at the post office, they check an identification I have to determine if it's me. They look for picture identification. It has to be government issued. In theory, unless I change my name or if I change my address, that's going to stay the same for my entire life, those components of my identity. The way we interact with businesses or the way customers interact with businesses, whether we're an employee of that business or a customer, is completely different. I hand over pieces of my identity to each of these companies in exchange for their services. This creates a huge attack surface. If every company that I work with has a little piece of my identity, it increases their security budget because they need to protect that. It gives me, the individual, less control over that identity, and so I don't know what someone's going to do with my attributes after I give it to them. And it's also a huge pain in the rear for me to access services because I have to give those attributes over individually to these companies. One of the interesting innovations in identity, obviously blockchain is a buzzword right now, but the distributed ledger technology that's underpinning blockchain has an interesting use case in customer identity management, and it's the concept of self-sovereign identity. There's a very interesting not-for-profit public foundation called the Sovereign Foundation that actually, as recently as last month, ran a proof of concept of self-sovereign identity at an identity management conference in California. And what's really promising about the idea of self-sovereign identity is the principle that the individual has control over the core attributes of their identity, and that there could be a system out there enabled by DLT that would allow me to store my key attributes, verify that those attributes belong to me, store them on this distributed ledger, and give companies, whether I work for them or I'm a customer of them, access to that information, and I govern it. Maybe one day they could pay me for that access instead of me paying them for a service. If companies want access to my data, they should pay me for it.
But who would do that initial governance and that initial validation? If we go back to the late 1990s, early 2000s, there was a lot of discussion as to how banks would be this broker. They were the trusted partner everybody had. Except it turned out they weren't the trusted partner everybody had, and nobody actually trusted the banks to set it up. Part of the problem was also regulation at the time. We're seeing some of that come back with the whole Know Your Customer regulations, where banks are now being given some leeway by regulators to work together. However, there is still that problem of how do you establish that first point of sovereign identity? Do we have to start from birth with a DNA record? What becomes a viable long-term approach?
The intrusion into the DNA records of the public through these companies, we could have a whole 45 minutes talking about that. But you've hit on one of the key adoption barriers to this idea of self-sovereign identity. I see three major adoption barriers. First of all, there's the verification problem. There still needs to be a frontline verification that takes place, and we would look to some centralized authority to do that. Two use cases where I see this happening. One in Canada, there's a company called SecureKey, which is partnered with the banks to run a program called Verified Me. And the idea is that if a bank verifies my identity, they've probably gone through some hoops to do so. The other companies in an ecosystem doing business in the country should be able to trust the identity verification that the bank does. And so if I leverage Verified Me, it means the bank that I'm a part of has verified me, and therefore I can parse out the credentials needed or the attributes needed to use other services. This still uses a central authority. The other use case of that I've seen is in Switzerland. You have municipalities that are starting to adopt this concept. To your point about starting from birth, I really think it comes down to there is never going to be, in my view, the complete absence of a centralized authority. As long as there are governments and there are nation states, there will always be a centralized authority that the rest of the users or individuals in a market look to as some sort of guiding light. That's still an adoption barrier to self-sovereign identity. The second adoption barrier is mass adoption. In order for this to become interesting to companies out there, you need someone who is a huge player in customer identity management, whether it's one of the vendors who creates the single sign-on tools of the world for customer identity management, or one of the large-scale tech companies who will build it themselves, a Google, an Amazon, not sure about a Facebook, if they can weather the storm and last. But until one of them goes to mass adoption and says, Google, for example, not only can you use your Google credentials to log into other services, it's backed by self-sovereign identity where you've been verified and we know who you are. We know that you're not a dog, as the classic comic goes on the internet, to know that you're not a dog. So that's the second barrier, is actual adoption. And the third that people don't often consider is that blockchain projects, like any other enterprise technology project, there's architecture, there are systems. Look at how many companies struggle with actually getting identity right using existing systems that are well known and well understood. How are we going to deliver a new complex architecture that most of the world doesn't understand? The same barriers to building that exist with any other technology project.
But is there not a fourth one here? If I think about, you've verified my identity, it's how do I protect my ownership of the verification key? We see credential theft day in, day out. We see fraud take place by people turning up, even to banks, and being able to pretend to be somebody else. There's a part of that that seems to be an even bigger barrier, and that's whether that's personal responsibility, whether that's a technology or an approach. How do we get that sorted out?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind for me is some sort of ongoing verification, because one of the biggest trends in identity management or in enterprise architecture in general is zero trust. Approaching an idea of zero trust because there's no more perimeter, all my users are remote, principle of least privilege, I need people to access things only when they need it and how they need it. And so if I'm in that zero trust world, and yet I'm trying to create, a lot of the blockchain identity programs use this concept of the web of trust, rebooting the web of trust. How do I, as a human, ensure that I trust the person that I'm interacting with on the other side? To me, the first thing that comes to mind is some sort of ongoing verification. The blockchain purists out there reject that as it's against the notion of having a centralized authority. But let's be real here. Innovation is usually most successful when it's iterative. It's not always a 10x moonshot from Google that changes the world. It's an iteration on the current problem. If you think about recent events and what led us here, the Cambridge Analytica scandal was a monumental moment. But as a security professional, I looked at what was happening in that incident and I said, the first thing that came to mind was, yes, people are outraged about this, but I doubt they violated the terms of service of Facebook. It turns out that it says that they did, but realistically, I think what that scandal points to is that consumers just have zero concept or engagement as to how their data is used as part of these terms of service. Yes, there's occasional media outrage, but life goes on. Instagram, owned by Facebook, and WhatsApp, owned by Facebook, had no brand impact. In fact, they were probably emboldened by this as people left Facebook to seemingly another platform. The point of all of this is that there really isn't going to be that huge wave that takes us to this new world, in my view, but something incremental would be a positive step forward. So if that's more municipalities taking this idea of self-sovereign identity and at least correlating your key attributes into a place that you can govern their access as a starting point, even if there is that ongoing human verification that is required, to me that's progress. We should look out for signs of that in the next 3 to 5 years.
A huge number of things to unpick in that answer. So let's take a very simple one, and that is those little pieces of information. If I look around the dark web, I can go and start to buy what is called a fool's profile of an individual. And those profiles today are becoming incredibly full and incredibly complex. And it's this information that's coming from hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of breaches, where that data is used as much to verify previously stolen data as it is to flesh out that data. People think, oh, I've only given this little bit of information here and this bit there. How do we get people to understand that actually it's not about the fact that, oh, that company was breached, yes, they only lost my name and address, but that's commonly available. It's the totality of all those little pieces of data that become the replacement for you.
It's an excellent point, and I have this debate with my colleagues as to whenever a public breach happens, are we past peak breach? And I think we can think about this concept as, have we passed peak privacy breach? What is peak privacy breach? In the U.S., the Office of Personnel Management breach was probably peak for the U.S., or maybe Equifax was peak. The next 150 million individual user breach that takes place, will we care anymore? Yes, people will be outraged. But I think if the individual consumer and the enterprise leader, if you approach it from the perspective of, let's assume we're past peak breach. It's the same concept of zero trust. It's saying, let's assume this user isn't who they say they are, and they should only have access to what they need, and they will need to verify they are who they are when they access it. If we approach the world in that sense, I hate to be so negative about it. It's not meant to be a doom and gloom answer. It's to say that if you assume that we're past peak privacy breach and certain attributes that you have are out there and compromised, so to speak, well, really, probably the only way to combat against that effectively is that ongoing verification model that we talked about. It's to say, let's come up with something that's past the password. Apple's Touch ID, Face ID goes in this direction to say, let's make it, first of all, easy and almost invisible to the consumer so that they can verify themselves when they interact with this technology. But let's also make it really verifiable in that way. Face ID with Apple is ultimately verifiable. The caveat to all of that is, it's still Apple governing that for me. I need to pay them. They're providing a service to me, and they're using my data to provide that service. They claim to be this great steward of privacy, and I have nothing to say negative about that. The intentions seem good. Ultimately, they're still a private company, which needs to provide profitable returns for their shareholder. The question for me is, let's say we approach the world as past peak privacy breach. A company like Apple is so pervasive, and if they're doing a good job of ongoing identity verification, I don't think it's so bad to have a private company that's playing that role in the market, because frankly, governments aren't doing it, nor do I expect them to get to it anytime soon. So why not have a robust private company doing it? I'm not personally against that. I think it's an interesting model for the future.
So one of the other things to unpick from your earlier answer and plays very much to this is the technology. We live in a world where whatever we do with technology is flawed. We make it overly complex. We're incapable of coding secure systems. We're incapable of maintaining those systems over a period of time. We know that because every day brings yet another zero-day attack. Every day shows another piece of flawed and wrong programming that wasn't picked up, that's widely distributed. We're moving to an API world now where those flaws will be hidden even deeper because people don't see an API in the same way as they might see an executable program or an application they buy. If we're going to advance the protection, how do we fix the broken model we have for creating technology so that it can't be so easily broken?
It's a fascinating discussion because there's no easy answer. Back to my point about following the money, there are significant companies out there. Veracode is one example, who secure code is what they're focused on. It's a booming company that was recently bought, and clearly there's money being invested in this field. But to me, it's all bolt-on. You can't be successful in this realm unless you approach it in a different way. And this is going to be challenging for many people, and I don't pretend that me saying it here makes it easy for anybody. You really need to blow up your existing program and start from scratch, or at least have that thought experiment. Get in a room and say, here's the constraints I face in my identity governance program today. Here are the things that I know are happening in my environment. To your point about APIs, one researcher called this the identity of things. You have the IoT and you have IDOT. People are forgetting that with the explosion of APIs, which are just software and systems talking to each other automatically, it's an identity nightmare because it's service accounts running wild and nobody's managing them. They don't go to the traditional identity program and say, hey, I just spun up a new API. I wanted to let you know that these service accounts are at work. Can you please monitor and manage them for me? Nobody's doing that. You have to sit in a room and strategize on what your identity approach is going to be and do it from that zero trust, from scratch approach. And I think that's the only way we can be successful. That may lead to you buying some tool that you bolt on to make sure you're deploying secure code. It may lead to you investing in one of these innovative technologies. But at the very least, you'll be able to have a conversation with your board or with your boss or whoever it is that you're asking for money for these programs for and say, here's where we're at today. If we take path dependence out of this, forget about everything we've done, this is the way we would like to approach it. We think we can get there in this amount of years. We think it could deliver cost savings for us and increase security. And here's how we're going to get there. Enterprise security leaders of the world need to be doing that. If they're not having that level of conversation, you will be endlessly caught up in just tools and programs and delivering no business value. It won't be very good for your company or your career, probably.
You mentioned blowing up the applications and starting again. We've seen attempts to clean this up. Windows 2000, Microsoft introduced the certified buy. Unfortunately, Microsoft couldn't put any of its own programs through that because, having told people they couldn't use a whole set of deprecated technologies, its problem was it didn't want to upset customers by taking them out of its own software as it moved to new versions. They're not alone. That applies to every large software vendor on the planet. As we've moved to cloud, people have realized that they can't just simply move to cloud. They've eventually got to rewrite the applications, re-architect the applications. Yet they still introduce more security fails. So they're blowing up the old application, and when they rewrite it, they introduce the problems yet again. Is it realistic to expect that we can get to a state where we can have much more trust in the software and the tools that we use?
It's not realistic for everyone. Let's not pretend that everyone's going to have the same outcomes. To your point about legacy software, there's always going to be someone making a business case to retain legacy software in your environment that can't interface with this new identity vision. That is just the world of business. There are going to be things that you can't change. That doesn't mean you should throw up your hands and give up. It means that you'd create different zones of risk. If you can segment or separate the zones of risk in your environment by saying, I have a business reality that is not going to change. I'm going to try to influence change, but I know this isn't going to change because I have a legacy X type of system, whether it's doing operational technology or cash management or something. That's not going to change right now. It's on a Windows XP and it's bubble wrapped and nobody's going to touch it. It creates a different zone of risk. You need to put additional controls around that. It's not the thing that I would love to spend money on. I would rather spend money on transformation, but we know transformation is hard for people. I truly do think, though, if you get buy-in at the executive level and if you present your vision in a way that is engaging to senior executives, they're going to buy into the transformation agenda. Really, these legacy applications, it usually comes down to the lack of political will to change them. To the cloud question, it's all about those zones of risk. If I have something that I've just thrown up into the cloud and tried to use traditional security controls on it, it's probably not going to have the same positive result as if I look at security from the cloud first. I would segment my environment in that way, and I would segment my thought process in that way to say, I have my cloud strategy, I have my legacy, and I need to make those play together. There's going to be different risk profiles for each of those architectures.
And that brings us back to engaging with the board. One of the problems of engaging with the board is people talk security, they talk breach, they talk regulator. The board is bored with this. If the board has a problem with transportation, it invests a chunk of money and it buys a new fleet of vehicles. If the board has a problem with buildings, it invests money, it builds new buildings, it sells off what it doesn't want. When the board's asked to invest money in cybersecurity, it says, look, here's a hole in the ground. Just pour your money in this, and next year, pour some more, and then more, and then more. We've got to change the conversation. For the last 2-3 years, a lot of the conversations I've had about how do we change this to risk. Are you starting to see that conversation move to risk? Or are we still approaching the problem in the wrong way when we try and engage with the board?
I see many CISOs go in that direction. I wouldn't say it's being done well across the board. The risk conversation is something that the board understands. Anyone who's gone through the director training that is required for all boards, it's really all about risk. The way that security will move its way higher up the food chain, and I mean that from an executive perspective, from a function that enables business instead of a function that disables business, is through this type of communication. It's through sales, frankly. It's through better internal sales of demonstrating how the program that I'm investing in now delivers business value. I had some statistics up in my workshop that showed what your future state metrics of your identity program should be. And they were stretch metrics. They're not something you're going to get to right away. But likely the future is you're probably going to have one killer app for identity. You're going to have one platform that is going to do most of what you need, or that you should look at having one platform instead of having all these different distributed technologies. The two other metrics were, and this is promised by a lot of vendors offering innovative services like robotic process automation. This is some metrics that are promised by them. I think they're realistic and we can get to them over time. So the second one is cost reduction. Some numbers that have been thrown out there is 80% cost reduction with robotic process automation. Well, that's a bit of a dream, but if I go to the board and say, I'm going to deliver business value and I'm going to deliver cost reduction, and then number three, speed and efficiency, I'm going to increase the speed and efficiency of our team so that I can sell more of what my company does, well, then that's magic. You have to align your security and risk discussion around what your company does. How does your company make money, and how are you making that go faster? If you're not making that go faster and you're being a disabler, you will always be in the lower rung. You'll be below the CIO. You'll maybe at the director, you know, whatever you are in the pecking order of the company. And I don't say that in a negative way at all. I just say that we can look at leading companies out there and judge their security maturity by where the CISO sits in the hierarchy. And I don't think we have enough CISOs that are up at the right hand of the CEO where they say, we're going to invest in a new market and a new business. I want the CISO here to tell me not only what the risk is, but also how approaching risk from day one and approaching security from day one will help make my business go faster instead of being a blocker for it down the road.
I'd like to think we can reset that arrangement, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. Ira, thank you for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.